On RN Summer, you're with All in the Mind. I'm Lynne Malcolm. Today, another chance to hear a highlight program from earlier in the year, Fast Mimes.
One of my ex-boyfriends always used to say, I absolutely love you until first thing in the morning, because I'd wake up and want to jump up and down on the bed and be like, wake up, poking him and all energetic and ready to go for the day. And he'd just be lying there going, I really hate you. Immature is the word that gets thrown around a lot, but I don't think immaturity is the right way to describe it. It's an energy.
Jessica Morrison is 26 years old. She manages a bar which suits her down to the ground, and she's excited about her future career in the wine industry. She was diagnosed with attention deficit disorder when she was in primary school, and along with 3-5% of adults in Australia, still experiences ADHD symptoms as an adult.
I was a pretty hyperactive out there child, which I think was a bit my personality, a bit the ADD. I was a very intelligent child that just could never understand school at all. Reading and writing, even to this day, are still a killer. And obviously you've got all the behavioural issues that come with ADHD. The older I got, the more it was aware that it was impossible for me to concentrate. Like, no matter how hard I tried, no matter what alternatives we tried, no matter what medications we tried, I just couldn't pay attention to anything. It was just all gibberish. I always needed to be doing two things at once, whether it was doodling or playing on my laptop, or I knew nothing would ever sink in. It is definitely still there. I mean, it never goes away. But I do find as an adult, people are a lot less sympathetic towards it. When you're a child, it's, oh, it's okay, she can't do that, she's got ADD. As an adult, people are like, oh, don't you get over that by now? It can be very frustrating and difficult because you are trying, you are doing your best. You probably work harder than anybody else at some of the simpler tasks, but no one's ever going to give you a pat on the back for it, because they kind of just have this attitude of, well, that's something you have when you're a kid, you should be over it by now. Not really grasping the understanding of, yeah, it is something that's diagnosed in your childhood, but it's something you've got for the rest of your life.
Unlike Jess, some people don't become aware that they have an ADHD condition until they reach adulthood. Dr. Caroline Stevenson is a clinical psychologist in private practice and specialises in ADHD across the lifespan.
ADHD in adults is slightly different from the experience of childhood. With children, you expect to see running around the room, not being able to sit still, very impulsive children. Or conversely, you'll see children like little wallflowers at the back of the classroom who are zoned out. With adults, it's very interesting because the presentation for adults is usually chronic disorganisation, problems with procrastination, or that they're actually in trouble with the law because of impulsive behaviour, like they come in with speeding offences or drug offences or just chaos.
Well, some people don't believe that this condition actually exists. What's the research that says that it does exist?
It's very interesting. The reason why we have got to the position that some people believe that ADHD doesn't exist is because research originally was inclined to show that you grew out of ADHD during adolescence. And the reason that idea persisted for a very long time was because hyperactivity dampens down. You do not see teenagers or adults running around the room and climbing over the furniture. The manifestation of that symptom in adults is very fidgety, restless, and that racing mind experience. So because hyperactivity dampened down, it led people to the belief that you grew out ADHD. But research that started in the late 1970s and then spanned into the last few decades actually showed that if you followed people over time, yes, the hyperactivity dampened down, but the other symptoms don't, so that you would continue to be inattentive, you would continue to have poor organisational skills, you would have problems dealing with boredom, and you would definitely have problems with procrastination. So while the hyperactivity, that was that actually changed in the way that it presented, that was what led to the idea that it disappeared. But in actual fact, the research doesn't support that.
And it can't actually start in adulthood, can it?
by definition, it's a childhood condition. It's a developmental condition that needs to start in childhood. But what we do know is that you can have symptoms that don't impair you until you reach adulthood, because as soon as you actually increase cognitive load on a person, you may get a manifestation of the symptoms to a degree that it impairs them.
So that would explain why some people don't realise they've got a condition, but their life seems to be out of control.
That's right. I mean, when I look at the presentation of adults, the first time that they come is their first year of university, for the reason that the cognitive load increases. They have suddenly got to organise themselves, get to classes, deal with the sustained attention, very independent in their learning. And they don't actually have the skill set to do it. They become very stressed, they get overloaded, and that might be a time that they actually present for treatment. Now, a second time that you get adults presenting for treatment is when their child has just been diagnosed. And as a result of their child being diagnosed with ADHD, they have the aha moment, oh my goodness, I have had all these symptoms myself and nobody actually recognised them. And when they look back historically, they exactly can tell you that they couldn't concentrate in the classroom, that they were chronically disorganised, and they've had major difficulties as an adult.
Caroline Stevenson. There's no one cause of ADHD. It's been linked to a number of factors, including prematurity, high lead levels in the bloodstream, and smoking during pregnancy. Any mild neurological impairment may also lead to the disorder, and it has a strong genetic component, so it tends to run in families. Dr. Craig Surman is a neuropsychiatrist and scientific coordinator of the Adult ADHD Research Program at Massachusetts General Hospital and Harvard Medical School. He's recently co-authored a book called Fast Minds with Tim Bilkey and Karen Weintraub. His concern is that adult ADHD is quite common, but the challenges are not well understood or managed.
We find that a lot of professionals are ill-equipped to help people understand whether they have the condition. So I think many adults have come to an understanding by their own research.
And it's not necessarily about the inability to pay attention, but of maintaining consistent engagement.
Right. Said very well. I think of attention deficit disorder as the most common sort of self-regulatory problem, meaning are people in control of what they do and when they do it? So things like getting around to assignments or paying the bills or putting paperwork in that place you managed to plan the paperwork, but gee, it's not there right now. There's organizational challenges that come as a result of these traits. And so this mix of impulsive, hyperactive, focus challenges, it's a real gamish of individually different kinds of problems, but we think of it all as what I call self-regulatory issues.
You talk about an engagement system in the brain. Can you explain this and how it's different for people with ADHD?
So a lot of what makes us humans different from other animals is our prefrontal cortex. And our prefrontal cortex helps us with things like selecting what we're going to put our effort into in a conscious way, and also unconsciously. It helps us keep long-range goals in mind. And we think about this area in particular in attention deficit, I think because it's what we can tweak with medicines, like stimulants often. It's not the only culprit, though, and it's connected to other regions that have a lot to do with ability to pay attention, for example, to the sound of my voice versus thinking about something else you have to do later. This is a selection of thought that I'm speaking of, but there's also a selection of sounds. There's also many competing motor activities in any given moment. So there's some system that allows us to govern and stick with particular planned action. And this is something that, you know, I call the engagement system. And what tends to happen is that things that are very easily engaged, things that are fascinating, I call them shiny or interesting, or even things that people are just naturally good at, tend to be very easy to engage in. Anything that's boring is harder for someone to engage in. But this kind of boredom factor is even worse for folks with attention deficit disorder. Their engagement system is a little bit loose, and there's multiple regions involved in the system, and some of them are really critical. And what we understand now is that there's other regions which are less critical but still very important for sort of fine-tuned attention. But they all kind of work together in harmony to allow control and engagement. It's kind of like, to use a sailing metaphor, you know, a keel of a boat. You know, you've selected a course, and are you going to be able to hold the course, or are you going to drift with the wind or drift with the current?
And it certainly wasn't smooth sailing for Jess Morrison through her adolescence.
I was a very angry teenager, and most people I know with ADD were angry teenagers. One of the best and worst things my parents ever did was ship me off to boarding school, which was hell. I hated every second of it. I hated feeling like a captive, especially because, as my sister likes to say, ADD kids are wild childs. It was like being a caged wild animal. But it gave me an outlet to focus on one thing, and through that I found that I was growing as a person, and I was finding other ways to not be so frustrated about not fitting in and not being so frustrated about not being able to express myself. So I found all these other ways to deal with that. But then when you become an adult and you're left to fend for yourself, it's like another battle all again. You don't have these teachers backing you up. You don't have these sports that you need to do. No matter what job interview I go to, I'm very upfront and honest about it. I'll always say I've got ADD, mildly dyslexic. And my boss, who's an awesome guy, I love him to bits. He's so sympathetic about so many things, but it's little things here and there that I know he gets so frustrated, and he tries to be sympathetic and tries not to let it bother him. Things as simple as emails. When I have to email a customer back saying yada, 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 something about a booking or something about a lost purse, he'll be like, you didn't capitalize the name and you didn't put a comma here. I'm like, I know, I'm sorry. And every time we kind of do a review or anything, he's like, and this needs to improve. And I've just got to turn around and say, I'm really sorry. Like, I'll work as hard as I can for you, but I can't fix that. It's a very small part of my job. And apart from that, I personally think I kill what I do, but it is something that's always going to be there. At school, they give you a bit of leeway. You've always got special allowances, things like that. Uni, you do a bit, but they're a lot less sympathetic. I sympathize with anyone with ADD at university. Universities need to pick up their game and realize that this doesn't go away and start making it a little bit easier for people like me to actually get through a university degree.
Things that are challenging or mentally effortful require a lot more. And that's often what people say to me coming in. You know, I just think I have to try harder. And I tend to ask them, well, how long have you been trying? And they may say 55 years. So a good portion of people have organizational challenges. We're talking about last minute pressure, deadline, scrambles, and it's been that way their whole life, and it's only the effort that it takes that's a burden. They're not getting fired. They're not having people complain. And so to understand if someone has attention deficit, you really want to walk in their shoes and ask, is there any other explanation? What I tend to find is that there's usually some period of time in a person's life where those explanations, those alternatives, just weren't in play, yet the traits are still there.
There's a gender gap too, isn't there? More men than women experience it?
Well, it's actually unclear to some extent whether clinicians in society are doing a really bad job by girls or if what you said is true, because the rates of diagnosis are four or more times as high in boys than girls. But when it comes to adults having recognized that they have a concern and they're coming into a clinic, in my experience and my colleagues' experience, it's about 50-50. The fact of the matter is that there's a lot of women who will tell me, I wasn't disrupting class. My brother with ADHD did. I was quietly passing notes in the back of the class. You know, and I got passed, but I've maxed out now. And I really find that I just can't keep on top of things the way I feel like I should. And I think I'm being reasonable about this. It's not just I'm a workaholic and trying to be perfect.
Dr. Craig Surman, neuropsychiatrist at Massachusetts General Hospital and Harvard Medical School. You're with All in the Mind on RN Summer, Radio Australia and online. I'm Lynne Malcolm, and today we're looking at fast minds and the experience of ADHD as an adult. Over her lifetime, living with attention and hyperactivity symptoms, Jess Morrison has been prescribed a range of treatments and medications.
I was on a cocktail of everything. They kept switching it to try and find the right medication throughout my life. I was mainly on dexamphetamine, and then at an older age I went to Ritalin, and then once it was introduced I went to the slow-release Ritalin. The medication did make a difference, but the side effects killed me. Even though they did help level out my hyperactivity, what they were doing to me in the long run, I still feel the effects of even today. Still, to this day, I have sleeping issues. The depression side effect never went away. Even just little things like nausea. Nausea is a massive side effect of a lot of the ADHD drugs, and to this day, the second I'm feeling anxious or the second my hyperactivity levels get up, I'm nauseous for the entire day.
Are you medicated at the moment?
No, I did go back on medication as an adult for about a year or so when I was 23 and just went, I can't do this anymore, and sworn to myself I'll never do it again.
Medication obviously doesn't suit Jess, but clinical psychologist Caroline Stevenson, who specialises in treating adults with ADHD symptoms, believes it can have an important role for many.
I always have the view that the best treatment of ADHD is multimodal, which means that most people will actually require some medication. And then I say it's a lot of hard work, which is putting strategies in place which actually help manage difficult behaviour.
And is it sometimes difficult to define? It mustn't always be clear that it's not depression or it's not anxiety, that it is ADHD.
Yeah, I think one of the reasons that ADHD is so controversial is the difficulties in unpacking it. For an adult presentation, they're rarely walking in the room with a clear ADHD. What might appear on the surface as a substance abuse problem, when you look in a bit, it looks like they were anxious, and then you look in a bit more, they had poor self-esteem issues, and then you look in a little bit more, you look like they just couldn't cope in the classroom ever because they had ADHD and they couldn't concentrate. Really, underneath the core was ADHD itself. But it's tricky, and one of the difficulties we have in Australia is really good education about ADHD across psychiatry and psychology and social work.
That's the challenge.
That's the challenge, yeah. And I would also say GPs recognising it, because in my experience, one of the major issues is that an adult might go to their GP and say, look, I really think that I've got the symptoms of ADHD, and the GP will say, well, that's a load of rubbish. And so here we're looking at trying to educate the professionals about what ADHD is.
In her practice, Caroline Stevenson incorporates the use of medication along with self-help techniques to treat adults whose lives have become chaotic due to their attention and hyperactivity symptoms. Her approach is the result of a research program she conducted for her PhD.
So the idea here was to not use medication, but to look at, can I teach life skills like time management, use of a diary, putting your keys in the same place, managing your stress better, impulse control, all these type of strategies, and seeing if it improves quality of life. My research has shown that if you can put in strategies, that you can get a third drop in your ADHD symptoms. And I have looked at this both in terms of an intensive intervention program and more like a self-help type program where people would have a manual and try to implement the strategies at home with a coach. And both approaches are actually fairly effective, but the more intensive intervention is actually better. And in some cases, for very motivated people, you can get as good improvements in symptoms as medication. Now, I have also looked at, are those people who are on medication, could they do even better if they, you know, have the strategies in place? This one has been difficult for me to unpack in terms of research because people coming to the research study were already prescribed medication. And so it's really hard for me to say whether I got a group of people whose medication wasn't working particularly well and therefore, you know, they were wanting strategies. But what I have shown is that it really doesn't make any difference. You can get a third drop in your symptoms whether you're on medication or not.
And the medication has also been controversial. It has been thought in some circles that there's been overprescription of medication for this condition. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think this is a very interesting question, because when you look at the number of people that we would predict to have ADHD, I think it's about 5% of the population. The number that are actually on stimulants is something like 0.1%. You know, it's a really low number of people who potentially have ADHD that are actually on stimulant medication.
Is this just in the adult group?
That's just in the adult group, yes, yeah. But the fear that we have a wide range of people taking stimulant medication for treating adult ADHD is not true. In fact, we have more people out there with ADHD that would actually benefit from being on medication than are treated at this point in time. I mean, one of the things that I can very clearly say is from my experience of 15 years working in adult ADHD is people benefit from medication and it significantly improves their quality of life.
Neuropsychiatrist Craig Surman from Harvard Medical School agrees that medication can be very helpful. But he's also a strong believer in assisting people to develop their own personal coping skills. His book, Fast Minds, How to Thrive If You Have ADHD, outlines the program he and his colleagues have developed.
There's so much that individuals end up doing on their own. People can empower themselves to change their environments in a workplace. It could be, you know, getting the cubicle that's the furthest from the lunchroom or someplace that's noisy. Develop skills that help them thrive. And these are things that don't necessarily require a pill. A pill might help if they have a lot of trouble following through on self-improvement. But sometimes it's really just as simple as finding the right strategies for them. One thing I harp on a lot is that our modern society tends to value jobs that require a lot of mind effort as opposed to hands-on work. And the lack of vocational training is astounding to me. You're asking square pegs to fit into round holes. And of course you get tuning out and daydreaming because you're taking people who are hands-on people and you're asking them to do more mental work. And I think what really matters is that an individual understands themselves, understands how these traits apply, and can really have a thoughtful conversation with someone who's going to try to walk in their shoes and entertain alternatives.
The hyperactivity when I was in other industries was a pain because I'd get really, really happy and really, really high and go like crazy and then all of a sudden I'd be dead. Whereas working in hospitality, it's actually a bit of a bonus. You're always on the go. So the ADD, if anything, is actually a benefit.
Yeah. Are there other areas that you think it helps you thrive as a human being?
Well, the multitasking. There's no one I know that can multitask the way somebody with ADD does because we need to multitask or we never concentrate on anything. So if you're in an industry, really anything that you have to be multitasking on a high level, it does become a benefit because you can concentrate on six things at once and you can give it your full attention.
And do you think you're more creative than you would be if you didn't have this condition?
Definitely, because it's what you have to rely on to get through school. You know you're never going to be the bookworm. That's never going to happen. So you actually need to find different outlets to express that you do have a brain. Because the most frustrating thing about ADHD is, and it's I think the reason a lot of kids with ADD have very high level of anger issues, is that you are an intelligent person, but you can't express it in the way that we conceive as conventional intelligence. You have to find other ways to prove to people that you're not dumb. For me now, it's a lot about wine and cocktails. I come up with very unusual ingredients for my cocktails, unusual flavours, and they work, and I love doing that. So you've got the multitasking there, and you've got the creativity.
What's your best cocktail, according to you?
Ooh, that's a tough one. We've recently put a new one on the list that I absolutely love, which is Goodbye Rhubarb Tuesday, which is our first ever dessert cocktail. So it's a cocktail that's designed to be had as a dessert. And it's a rhubarb and vanilla puree with gin, a few different flavoured liqueurs in there, a little bit of strawberry, a little bit of raspberry. And we've got grated white chocolate on top, so it actually looks like a rhubarb crumble and it tastes like one as well. And oh, it's the naughtiest cocktail, but it's so good. Wow. I don't normally like chocolate and stuff in cocktails. I think it's a bit 80s, but somehow we made this one work.
I must say, it sounds like a lot of fun working at the bar with Jess Morrison. But no doubt there are challenges to being close to someone who seems chaotic, impulsive, and can easily fly off the handle. And sometimes people with these symptoms don't even recognise that they have a condition. So what are the best ways for family and friends to help?
I think that if an individual is very interested in support, then there's a lot that a family member can do. And to some extent, this can put a loved one or a significant other, you know, friend, coworker, whoever, in an awkward position. It can be a burden. There are some folks who, for example, will find themselves leaning on caretaker types and putting real strain on relationships. And so I think it should be ideally, I want to be available to help you adapt, but, you know, I want to know that you're going to meet me partway on this. But I really hesitate to overburden. I think that it should be a collaboration.
Dr. Craig Surman, neuropsychiatrist from Massachusetts General Hospital and Harvard Medical School. And he's co-author of Fast Minds, How to Thrive If You Have ADHD.
So tell me more about some of the strategies that you've developed for yourself, because you've decided not to be on medication. What are some of the things, the tools that you use to keep your life in control?
Diet and exercise is incredibly important, and allowing yourself a lot of personal time. I find it's really important for me to analyze my day at the end of the day, where I go home and I sit in bed and I'm like, was I happy with how I was today? All right, Jess, so what are you going to do next time? And one thing that every shrink and every pathologist my parents ever sent me to is, before you get angry, before you get upset, just walk away. I have actually learned that's the worst advice anyone can ever give you. It doesn't work. Now I've actually learned you can turn around and walk away without moving a step and looking like you're listening. You just mentally switch off and just go, I agree. I can sit there calm as anything and literally have no idea what they're saying, and I am not listening in the slightest. It's probably really rude, but no one's ever caught me out, although after this I think they might.
You mentioned you've had therapy. How has that helped?
I was lucky to have a great psychiatrist, and I think it's important to have a psychiatrist that does understand what your wants are. If you want to stay on medication, no judgment at all. I think for some people it's the right decision. For me, I knew it wasn't. He was fantastic. I was very lucky, but I do think it is important for people with any form of learning disability to have that professional person to talk to. But I think it's best for your sanity to not let them be a yes person. Because all you're going to do then is coast through life thinking, poor me, I've got ADD, or I've got dyslexia, or I've got Asperger's, and my life's so hard and everyone's out to get me. Whereas if you've got someone who's being straight with you and logical with you and saying, no, your life's not that hard. Somebody dying of cancer's life's hard. Your life's not that hard.
And you seem to have a really good understanding of yourself now.
Yeah, I think actually more than most people, I understand myself. I think it's also given me the ability to understand other people better. I'm not good with people who are sick or have hurt themselves, because I very much am like, eh, suck it up and walk it off, princess.
Because you've had to do that for yourself, really, haven't you?
Exactly, especially like I was constantly sick as a child. And so you get a bit unsympathetic towards that. But when it comes to actual proper emotional issues, you can pick it a lot easier. You can normally read someone very quickly and understand someone very quickly. It does help in your dating life because you can weed out the jerks very, very quickly.
Thanks to Jessica Morrison for sharing her story with us. For more information relating to today's program, visit our website at abc.net.au/radionational. And while you're there, leave a comment. I'd love to hear your thoughts. Best wishes for a happy and peaceful festive season, and I look forward to being with you again next week. Next on RN, The Philosopher's Zone with Joe Gelonesi.